The transgender community is an area of diversity that we've heard of, but might not know much about. This hour, the challenges faced by some transgendered people. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, my guest is Steph Schuster, a transgender activist and researcher at the University of Iowa. We'll find out how being transgender can be a challenge, especially when it comes to visiting the doctor's office. Then in the second half hour, Princeton historian Nell Irvin Painter. Her most recent book is titled The History of White People. It's a comprehensive look at the idea of the white race as a social construct throughout history. That's all coming up right after a look at this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The transgender community is an area of diversity that many of us have heard of. We're aware of it, but we might not know much about it. Transgender people do not identify with a gender that corresponds to the sex they were assigned at birth. Today, as part of the University of Iowa's annual MLK celebration of human rights, my guest is giving a talk about one particular aspect of living as a transgendered person: healthcare. Steph Schuster is a PhD candidate who specializes in medical sociology and gender. Steph is also a transgender activist and joins me in the studio. Hi, Steph.
Hello.
Your talk, I see, is titled Building Positive Care Relationships Between Healthcare Workers and Transgender Patients. Now, the title tells me that there's room for improvement between healthcare workers and transgender patients. What are the chief things you see need fixing?
Sure. Well, that is an important question. It's also a large question. I've spent quite a bit of time now doing research on the history of provider and transgender community relationships and also more contemporary practices. Imagine going to the doctor for any kind of routine visit, and the doctor doesn't know how to interact with you. That, I think, you know, it's one of those small everyday occurrences that a lot of trans people face, mm-hmm. That a lot of other people don't necessarily have to think about.
Okay, make that more concrete to us, because you are transgendered.
Mm-hmm.
So give me a concrete example of going to a healthcare provider and having some, I suppose, awkwardness, or just it's not as fluid as one would wish for.
Right. From the moment that a lot of trans folk walk into a clinic, what is the first thing that you have to do? You fill out a patient intake form. Forms often don't allow room for the possibility of trans people to exist. One of the basic questions is, what is your gender? And often it says female or male, and we can certainly get into the nuances of how those are actually sex categories and not gender categories. But for trans folk, it makes it a difficult, like that kind of limited, you know, one or the other for a lot of people is difficult.
Mm-hmm. So when you go to a medical provider, what box do you check?
Mm-hmm. You know, like in navigating some of these more structured occurrences, I like to think of creative solutions. So often I'll kind of create my own box.
You'll create a third box.
I will. Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, wasn't this made part of online form for the University of Iowa not too long ago, in addition to male and female? There's a third box, which is called, I forget.
I think the third option now for incoming University of Iowa students is, if they want to, they can self-select to identify as transgender.
Mm-hmm. So you're suggesting in a medical setting, mm-hmm. what would be optimal at that first step, checking in?
Yeah, well, I think this is like where it gets a little tricky. Because on one hand, there are some trans folk who would want, even for some of those routine visits, for their provider to know that they're transgender. And for others, I think that the perspective is that it's inconsequential, mm-hmm. right?
So you have a cough or a cold.
Right.
It doesn't matter what gender or sex you are, right?
Right. So that definitely is some people's perspectives. I think a lot about, and in the research that I do, what comes up often is, you know, like the politics of someone touching your body. If that is within a trans-specific medical encounter or even something mundane, such as like going in for a cough or a cold, I'm of the perspective that if a provider is going to be touching my body, I want them to have some awareness before they engage that, that my body is like a trans body.
So how would you explain that to a medical care provider? How do you clear up that ambiguity so that the examination or whatever can go on and you can find the, whatever problem you might have that day?
Right. So this is definitely one of those areas where I think both trans folk and providers feel a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of uncertainty in these kinds of encounters. And how would I approach that? I think that usually if it's a provider that I don't know, it's simply sharing that information, whether it's the intake form or whether in that initial conversation, you know, in some way indicating that I'm a trans person for me is important. But it's not – like this is not everyone's experience, right? So I think that's also where it gets really complicated and where a lot of that uncertainty comes up for providers as well. If someone's not really well-versed in trans people, how to interact with them, how to interact with trans bodies, you know, like it creates a lot of anxiety.
Okay. It sounds like a lot of what is needed is an awareness raising. A lot of people listening right now would not have very much awareness about trans folk, as you say, and what it is, because it's not simply a third category, because as I understand it, transgender can be many things.
Mm-hmm.
And this is perhaps a misconception that you run into, is there are how many subcategories of transgender, for instance?
I don't think that it's bounded by a number.
You're not even going to go there with me. Okay. So how do you, within transgender category, how do you describe yourself further when you want to go further than just transgender, period? What do you say after that to be more specific about yourself?
So I identify in some spaces as transgender because I think that is a well enough known term, but I embrace a genderqueer identity. And for me, that means I see my gender as more fluid and that I don't fit neatly within a category of man or woman.
Okay. So past, when we talk past intake forms, when you're going to see a medical professional, what other sorts of standardization in the field do you see as a problem for transgender people?
Sure. So I think that in looking at the ways in which the medical field has shifted over time, certainly we're moving in a direction towards more and more standardization. And I think this applies to all areas of medicine, where the notion of, you know, like something like a clinical guideline, there are clinical guidelines for just about everything, you know, flus, how providers should treat, you know, people who have flus.
And that's a practical necessity, isn't it?
Well, so I think that this is a place where looking specifically at trans medicine reveals some of the fundamental contradictions in our healthcare system. When we go to a doctor, I think the expectation that we have is that doctors will be both compassionate and also experts in how to treat us. And so I'm certainly not saying that clinical guidelines or standardization equals bad, right? These tools that providers use help them make decisions that ordinarily could, you know, just be based on whatever they think they should do. So it provides some structure. What I do want to problematize here, I think, is that for transgender people, and we've talked about how, you know, identities make up like there's so many different trans identities. And so if we're taking such a like a regimented standard or like clinical guideline and trying to put it on top of trans people's experiences and treat all trans people in the same way, it becomes really tricky because this one social worker said, there is no such thing as a trans person. There is a this person, and a this person.
We're all individuals.
Right, right. So it becomes difficult, I think, when we're trying to get providers to work in trans-specific medicine to, you know, to negotiate that gray area between here's what the clinical guidelines say, and here's what this client is telling me, and trying to like find, I think, some middle ground between the two.
Okay. Middle ground, and not just pigeonholing people into existing categories.
Right, right.
You mentioned earlier something that I'd like you to go back to, because we tend to think, and you said it was on the form indicated as such, that gender and sex are seen as equivalent by mm-hmm. many people, but they're not. Explain that.
You know, like one of the tools that I think feminists and also social scientists have given us is the idea that sex and gender categories are distinct. But in our society, we tend to assume that they are kind of neatly lined up in this really nice ratio where if someone is assigned female at birth, that they will go on to identify as a woman. And if someone is assigned male at birth, that they'll identify as a man.
Assigned, meaning they have genitalia of male or female.
Right. And like even there, I think it would be an entirely different conversation of like the ways in which even our sex categories are socially constructed. I'm thoroughly a social scientist. I come from that perspective. And I think about the ways in which even sex categories has shifted over time historically and how we come to identify some bodies as female or other bodies as male.
It's interesting because this is the community here in Iowa, the community in the world, in the nation, is having to get up to speed fairly quickly on transgender, what it is, and how perhaps to be a more inclusive society, to reflect the diversity that is in our society, to gain awareness and adjust where needed. Now, it's interesting to think that this was seen as a mental illness not too long ago. How long ago?
I think in some circles it still is.
Okay.
But I think that – it gets tricky, right? So if you look at the American Psychiatric Association's most recent diagnostic and statistical manual, it's shifted, but gender dysphoria now appears in that manual. So in some ways symbolically, trans identities or gender variance is still included in some ways as symbolically a mental illness. But I think that the perspective of a lot of healthcare workers has certainly shifted in the last 50 years.
In what ways has it shifted?
Right. You know, particularly if we go back to the mid-20th century, there was a lot of pathologizing of trans people's experiences. And providers and also scientists who were working at that time really had no language with which to describe trans people's experiences. And so they came up with all kinds of terms or like existing language. So if you go back to those documents, you'll see some providers talking about schizophrenia or like trans people as representing a form of schizophrenia. And I imagine that, the idea went something like this. I had a patient come in today who's a man and told me that he wanted to be a woman. And at that time, it seemed and I don't want to like reproduce like oppressive language, but, it at the time, I think it was perceived as just entirely crazy, and over time, as more trans people have been publicly identified, have talked about their experiences, that idea has shifted somewhat. That a lot of people now have some idea that there are people in the world who may feel like another gender than what they're expected to be.
And also to be clear here that you can be transgendered without having any sort of medical intervention on your body.
Mm-hmm.
You can stay the way you were born
mm-hmm.
in perhaps a male body, identify as female. And you said earlier that you thought it was people understood the term transgender, but I don't think they always do, because most people or a lot of people would think that transgender means you had something surgically done.
Right, right. So I think that comes for the most part. Like if you look at mass media representations of trans people, the most common story that's presented involves some kind of medical intervention, right? So it's like that's the language that a lot of people have to understand trans people's experiences. When you start speaking with trans people, that changes quite significantly. Transitioning can be physical, emotional, spiritual, and I think that this is where those categories of sex and gender, like how we in some ways really need to think of them as distinct categories because of this very issue, that you don't have to have some kind of medical intervention in order to claim a trans identity.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Steph Schuster. Steph is a PhD candidate, specializes in medical sociology and gender, also a transgender activist. And Steph is part of the University of Iowa's annual MLK celebration on human rights, giving a talk about where transgendered people intersect with our health care, I guess would be one way to say it. Now, I know with your research, Steph, you've gone way back and you referred to this decades of research. Research narratives of transgendered folks, looked through the archives at the Kinsey Institute, and you've interviewed how many transgendered people, would you say, in the course of your research?
So I have conducted 40 interviews with trans people across many of those different spectrums of trans identities.
Being transgendered yourself, what did you gain from those interviews that you didn't know before? Because you're only one individual. Mm-hmm. What jumped out at you as themes for transgendered people mm-hmm. growing up in the United States?
One of the really heartbreaking realities of being a trans person is the everyday violence that a lot of trans people experience. So my interviews with trans folk were concentrated in a Midwestern metropolitan area. And maybe it's because of the specificity of that location. There were
mainly Iowa City.
No. And because of human subjects protocols.
You don't want to identify it.
Right.
Gotcha.
But, you know, the percentages of trans folk who were underemployed or unemployed was just astounding. And, you know, I think about the ways in which, like everything that we've already been talking about in this conversation, how a lot of people don't know how to respectfully interact with trans people, how a lot of legal documents might not match up with someone's, like what it says on your birth certificate might change with your driver's license, might change with how you present in the world, all leads up to employment as one really structured area where it's difficult to navigate as a trans person.
Mm-hmm. When the people that you were interviewed, when you're transgendered and you're trying to get a job, mm-hmm. Something makes me think you tend to cover that up if you want a job at this day and age? Or?
Right. So I think it's different for every person. It's certainly something that resonates with me right now as I'm on the job market, how to negotiate even like if you are asking someone to write a letter of recommendation, for example, and they know you under one name or some pronouns, and you go into that interview and, you know, it doesn't quite match up. In our society, I think that we tend to have a lot of what sociologists would call like implicit bias, right? Mm-hmm. And it's in those like when what we expect someone or some group to be. And then we encounter that group and it doesn't meet those expectations, there's a little bit of panic. And I think that it has to do with like when we have these expectations going into even just like a conversation.
Right.
And all of these ideas and messages and stereotypes that we have about certain groups, it all percolates into that like interaction. So in a setting like an interview for employment, it might not even be intentional, right? And it might not even be a conscious process. But if we're set down before someone and have all these things going on internally, then I think I'm not saying it's fair, but it makes sense that it would be really difficult for a trans person over another candidate to get that same job.
Mm-hmm. I see. But some of these things are really fundamental that have to do with interpersonal communication. For instance, you mentioned pronouns. Now, if I would say instead of Steph is also a transgender activist, I would say he is or she is a transgender activist. Mm-hmm. You agree with neither of those pronouns, right?
Right, right.
So what would you prefer if I would use a pronoun in your a description like that?
Yeah. So as someone who kind of inhabits a more gender fluid identity, my pronouns are they, them, and theirs. The sentence structure would be Steph is a transgender activist and they also are a PhD candidate.
They also, and using a singular verb with they.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So you're still single. Singular, I mean to say, as an individual rather than a plural. You mentioned respectful interaction. What are the ways that we can better interact with transgender people? What mistakes do we make mm-hmm. that are perhaps hurtful?
I wonder what it would be like for everyone in everyday situations to start off, "Hi, my name is Steph. My pronouns of reference are they, them, theirs. What is your name and what are your pronouns?"
That's not a conversation starter.
No, it usually is not.
But you are asking people to
I am.
Have another category. I mean, you really can't blame people for not knowing how to interact with someone who doesn't like to be referred to as he, she, his, hers. That's something we haven't come across.
Right. And I think that, like, for me, what I really can kind of get behind in this idea of, you know, like, even these basic name and pronouns, I think really is about the idea of self-authorship and allowing room and space for everyone to be able to share with other people a basic kind of interactional mechanism of what name do you want me to use to refer to you, right? Mm-hmm. I think that certainly is one of the big ones.
We're almost near the end of our conversation, but we've spoken about a lot of the challenges that come with being trans. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could share with me some of the joys of not being male or female.
Mm-hmm. There's certainly a creativity that can come with being a trans person. And, coming up with strategies to negotiate all of these encounters, I think it in some ways indicates quite a bit of resilience that trans folk have in negotiating these everyday encounters.
And that makes you proud.
I personally have a difficult proud is difficult for me. I think joyful feels a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, so creativity is one of the joyful aspects for me. I think also for some people, they talk about it almost like a spiritual awareness. When one is faced with challenges in large structures like healthcare or employment or housing, and then even like, you know, on the ground level, all these interactions, that sense of struggle, I think, can help. It's almost like form a sense of a spiritual awareness of one's place in society and one's place in the world and what that means and what we can imagine that we want that to look and feel like.
Well, we'll have to have you back. It's been very enlightening. Steph Schuster, PhD candidate who specializes in medical sociology and gender at the University of Iowa, also a transgender. They is a transgender activist.
Almost. They are. So it's actually...
Oh, you do get to be plural.
Yeah.
Okay. They are also a transgender activist. That's going to take some getting used to, Steph. But I've enjoyed the conversation. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with historian Nell Irvin Painter. Her most recent book is titled The History of White People. It's a comprehensive look at the idea of the white race as a social construct. She'll be speaking tomorrow at Iowa State University's Memorial Union. We'll look at really interesting questions such as how far back can we trace the idea of the white race and how did it come to be that the white race was thought to be superior? Or why are white people often referred to as Caucasian? We'll try to get the answers to those questions and more when we return with historian Nell Irvin Painter, The History of White People. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is historian Nell Irvin Painter. Her most recent book is titled The History of White People. It's a comprehensive look at the idea of the white race as a social construct. She's also author of other books, including Creating Black Americans and Southern History Across the Color Line. Painter is Edwards Professor of American History Emerita at Princeton University. She'll be speaking next week. I misspoke before the break. It's not tomorrow. It's next Wednesday, January 29th, at Iowa State University's Memorial Union Great Hall, and she joins us for the remainder of this hour. Professor Painter, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much.
Before I ask you about white people as a social construct. Let's talk first about the idea of race. What, if anything, is the genetic difference between people of different skin colors now that we have the human genome unlocked?
Mm-hmm. There are differences that relate to skin color. Skin color has to do with melanin and how everybody has a lot of melanin. The question is how much melanin gets expressed. And so we're talking about proteins. So there are some genetic differences about regulating the proteins that express the melanin, and that has to do with ultraviolet radiation. Ultraviolet radiation is absolutely necessary for the formation of bones and for the maturing of the fetus. But if you get too much ultraviolet radiation, it can cause cancer. The ones we know best is skin cancer. But if you don't get enough, then you have weak bones. So throughout evolution, our proteins and our genes have adjusted to the amount of ultraviolet radiation in the environment.
Mm-hmm. And the human race has done this, can do this with a remarkable speed when you talk about human evolution. And
yes.
What is it in 100 generations it would take me as a lighter skinned person to turn to a darker?
The fastest way is to have sex with a darker person.
Okay.
Really, and that's how people do it, basically.
Okay. But overall, the difference scientifically in terms of genes that we have when we talk about race is what?
Well, beyond dealing, there's some physical differences, but you can't say, oh, all the black people are tall or all the light-colored people are fat. You can't make big generalizations like that. So in terms of a biological differences, no, race is not helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too gross a term. And mostly when we think about race, we think about really things like temperament and so forth. So the people tend to talk as though races had temperaments, as though black people were temperamentally able to dance and white people were temperamentally, patient. And, you said it very well when you said social construct.
Mm-hmm. So how far back can you trace this social construct, this idea of a white race?
Well, as a scientific construct, it goes back to the 18th century, to the Enlightenment. Now, that doesn't say that people couldn't tell the difference between people's colors. They could. But the idea of making that science, that's from the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. Science then said what about race and gave us the idea of scientific race or the science of race?
Depends on who you ask. So, for instance, some people thought there were five races. That's Blumenbach. Some people thought there were two races. His colleague who thought there were two races, ugly and pretty. some people thought there were three. In the 20th century, the scientific justification was for three, Caucasoid, Mongoloid, and Negroid, in that order. So it depends on who you ask and for what purpose.
Mm-hmm. Does it go back even further than the Enlightenment to thousands of years ago, or was there not such a thing as a race then?
It's a scientific construct. It goes back to the Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, as I said, people could tell differences. So, for instance, the elite ancient Greeks, who we know had their games, and they were men, and they participated with no clothes on, and they got a very nice brown. And they would make fun of the Persians for being so pale and pasty because the Persians didn't have games outside, and they weren't athletic.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, being pale and Persian was kind of to be non-manly.
We tend to think of we've been handed down from previous generations, the idea that the Scandinavians and Germans were the whitest of the white race. How did that come to be? Did that stem also from the Enlightenment?
Yeah. It's kind of late 18th, early 19th century, and it has to do with German nationalism and also with English nationalism and American nationalism, the idea that the Anglo-Saxons were the best people and the smartest people and so also the whitest people. And since Anglo-Saxons and Germans were largely up there in the north, you know, that kind of held on because their bodies didn't want to express the melanin at all, you know, as little as possible. Let's get as much ultraviolet radiation as we possibly can. There was always a problem with going too far north, though, into the really cold areas of the Arctic. So, for instance, Blumenbach, who's my favorite expert, wrote three editions of his study about the races of mankind. He called them the varieties of mankind. And sometimes the Lapps were in with Caucasians, and sometimes they weren't. And as I read the various scientific treatises about human taxonomy, the Lapps, for instance, would go back and forth depending on what the criteria were. And very often the criteria were beauty. And so if you thought the Lapps were ugly, then your kind of taxonomy would not put them in with white people. Mm. It's the same problem also with Jews. You know, are Jews Caucasians? Well, yes, but then with an asterisk. So the classification is nobody ever found a definitive classification. And if you look up the number of races right now or the number of white races right now, you will find conflicting testimony.
Was there a time in the early part of the 20th century, for instance, when we had a lot of Irish immigrants that they were not immediately recognized as white?
No, Irish people have always been recognized as white in the United States, even when they were subject to denigration when they were very poor in the middle of the 19th century. But the thing is that in the 19th century, educated people thought that there were more than one white race.
I see.
So the Irish were white people, but they were not Anglo-Saxons or Saxons. In the 19th century, the best race was the Saxon race or the Anglo-Saxon race, depending on where you were and who you were writing to. But by the early 20th century, when there were other Europeans coming who were poor, and Irish Americans had sort of moved up the ladder thanks to education and patronage jobs, so then in the early 20th century, there was a new classification called Nordic. And the Nordics were the Northwestern Europeans. And so that put the Irish into the good, smart part.
Okay. If you've just joined us, my guest is historian Nell Irvin Painter. Her most recent book is titled The History of White People. She's also written other books, including Creating Black Americans. So when we talk about white, the white race as being a social construct, you just referred to another of your book. So Black Americans, that is a created social construct.
Sure.
So describe that one.
Well, again, nobody can agree on how do you define black people, or even what do you call black people. I use black because that's a nice general term, and it includes people who are immigrants, recent immigrants, and people whose roots go back, like my own, centuries in the United States, or what became the United States. And it kind of finesses how people think about what it means. But we also have African American. In the 20th century, there was a big struggle to get to Negro with a capital N. And then there was colored. And then People who were in the United States of African descent in the early 19th century often called their institutions African, whether or not they had been born in the United States. But I think we're more used to changing terminology and kind of wobbly definitions when we deal with black race than with white race.
Mm-hmm. I've always wondered what determines whether we move on from one label to the next, Negro, colored, onto black or African American.
Well, the short answer is power.
Power.
Uh-huh. That's the short answer. That's too easy because there's other stuff going on like money.
Yeah, all right.
Beauty. So, you know, there's some other big words, but let me just stress that it depends on who is talking, when and to whom, for what purpose, what the definition is of races or varieties. They're not freestanding.
In your book, The History of White People, you talk about the definition, and you've described a little bit of how whiteness has changed or expanded in the mm-hmm. United States mm-hmm. since the founding of the United States. Mm-hmm. Briefly tell us how you see that expansion proceeding.
Yeah, I talk about four big expansions. The first one is not so much an expansion of white people because it occurred in the Jacksonian era of the early 19th century. But that is when men who were considered white by the local political powers that were able to vote. And as I mentioned earlier, patronage jobs, which are directly related to voting, are absolutely crucial in upward mobility. And upward mobility is tied intimately to racial classification. So the Jacksonian era is the first big enlargement, and it has to do with voting. So, for instance, Irishmen in the Boston area in 1850 or 1860 could have been considered inferior races, the Celtic race, but they could vote. So that's the first one. The next one is the turn of the 20th century. When the Irish went from being a despised Celtic race and got elevated into the Tony Nordic race. And then the third one is in the middle of the 20th century, in the 1940s and 50s, when the formerly despised Southern Italian, Northern Italian, East European, Hebrew, Slavic. These are the names that people used at the time. They're not my names. Those supposedly inferior white races got elevated into one big white race. So that's the 1930s, 40s, 50s. And suburbanization and lending practices, the Federal Housing Authority, for instance, federal law was the plaything of Southern Democrats who were very focused on black-white. And so federal policy in the middle of the 20th century tended not to be so good to black people, but to foster the interest of this larger, one big white race.
Mm-hmm. Where are we now in this expansion?
Right now, we're in the fourth one, and that is where people who are brown-skinned but who are rich or powerful or have ancestry, say, in Southern Asia, are no longer burdened by the disabilities of blackness, which means that the advantages of whiteness are relatively reduced. So, for instance, we have a black president, and being a president used to be something that was reserved for white people, white men.
Mm-hmm. So President Obama fits into this progression, this expansion. Mm-hmm. In what way? It was inevitable, given the expansion's direction.
No, nothing's inevitable. I mean, if you have an expansion, you have an expansion, but right. That's not the only thing that can happen. There can be contractions as well. So I think we've seen a rise in some very ugly outbreaks of racist talk and action.
Let me ask you about something else in the recent news when we talk about the past few years. This was even more recent than the election of Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. We had the recent controversy over a Fox News host, Megyn Kelly, saying that Santa Claus is white, and she says he just is.
Yeah.
And by the way, so is Jesus.
Yeah.
What did that remark? It was in reaction to a Salon.com column, I believe, and the controversy it set off.
Yeah.
What does that tell you about the attitudes of toward race today?
Well, it doesn't tell me anything because there's no such thing as the attitude. We are a country of 320 million people. We can't sum us all up in one word or one attitude. We know that there are many people who hold liberal attitudes about race, and we would not have found that so widespread another generation back or two. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that people don't say stupid things, as she did. I mean, where was Jesus? You know? I mean, I'm laughing as you said that, and I have read it. But the idea that Jesus is like, you know, the white person down the block, that's just ludicrous.
Tell us why, though.
Well, I'll give you another example, a parallel. And this is a 19th century parallel. There was a scientist, Samuel Morton, in Philadelphia, who made a very nice reputation on skulls. And he was an expert on ancient Egyptians. And he decided that you could tell something about ancient Egyptians by looking at their wall paintings. This makes a lot of sense, I think. But in these wall paintings, the ancient Egyptians had fluffy hair. You know, they had kind of triangular head hair. And if you walk out in the street, now I live in Newark, New Jersey, so I can walk out on the street, not on a day like today, but, you know, in better weather, and I can see a lot of fluffy hair. Fluffy hair is pretty African. But Morton said, no. These people, you know, they were kings. They were powerful. They were rich. So they couldn't possibly have African hair.
Right.
So he said, they're wearing wigs over white people hair. And you think, what? And then, you know, in my book, I say, well, not only did he say this with a straight face, but he didn't explain why rich, powerful Egyptians would want to wear wigs that made their hair look African. You know, so people will say anything. Remember I said earlier, to whom are you speaking, when, and to what purpose? And so the commentator was speaking to her audience for the purpose of putting down the woman who seemed to have insulted her. It was not a statement. A smart statement.
We have about a minute left before we have to say goodbye for now, Professor Painter. I wonder, what do you want to look at in the future as a historian? What's your next target? What have you been working on?
I am no longer writing history books. I went to art school. I have a BFA and an MFA in painting. I got my MFA in 2011, and I am a painter. And I'm thinking, after I visit you in Iowa, I'm going to go up to the Adirondacks and sit around by myself for a while and decide whether or not I'm going to do an artist book, that is, with pictures, called Old in Art School.
Hmm. Okay.
And if I decide to do that, that will be my next project. Otherwise, I'll just go to my studio and draw and paint.
Okay, very good. And I'm assuming the people you paint will have hues of many different skin colors.
Well, I don't paint that
you don't need to answer that. That's just an offhand remark. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Because we're talking about race, of course.
Yeah, sure.
Historian Nell Irvin Painter, thank you for joining us this half hour.
You're very welcome.
Professor Painter will be speaking next week at 8 p.m. Wednesday, January 29th at Iowa State University's Memorial Union in the Great Hall. And the great talk show host Charity Nebbe joins me in the studio. I don't know why I had to make that tie. You are great.
Sure. Thank you.
What's going to come up tomorrow at 10 o'clock on Talk of Iowa?
Well, Centerville, Iowa is a small town just a few miles north of the Missouri border, a town that's easy to overlook, but it has a fascinating history. And we will dig into that history tomorrow. We'll talk about the Underground Railroad, the Ku Klux Klan, Prohibition, the Mafia, the Depression era.
Are we talking about Centerville, Iowa?
Centerville, Iowa.
Oh, man. Really?
So that's coming up.
It's not a work of fiction either.
No. Enfys McMurray wrote Centerville, a Mid-American Saga. So I'll be talking with her tomorrow.
Can't wait. Charity Nebbe with Talk of Iowa tomorrow. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on the program, Politics Day, Iowans are gathering for caucuses, but not to determine who will win the party nomination for president, but who will control the parties. Join us.